Let's go straight to the book of Genesis, chapter 16. Starting in verse 7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that it is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai," she answered. We're in chapter 16, verse now 9. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." I've been heard probably thousands of sermons in my life. I'm not sure I've ever heard anybody preach about Hagar. I'm sure I've never heard anybody start a sermon about Hagar. Here's this woman who often we in the Christian world look at as the mother of Islam, the mother of Muslims. Here's the outcast woman of the family or the household of Abraham. There's scandalous stuff that happens to get her pregnant with a offspring of Abraham. And she's just not looked at very fondly. But in the last verse that I read to you, she calls God, "You are the God who sees me." She's overlooked even by us who study the scriptures. So I want to ask you, do you know where Hagar comes from in this story? Most of us probably do, but some of us may not or may not remember. If you remember, Abraham went into a land where he was afraid that his wife Sarah was going, or he would be killed because of his wife Sarah. And he told his wife to kind of tell a lie. Now, I preached one time about he lied here and someone came up and said, "Well, Sarah was kind of his half-sister." No matter what, whether it was specifically, the intent was he was trying to deceive. So he was trying to tell somewhat of a lie. And because of that, when they found out, they gave him slaves and concubines and animals to get him out so that God would not punish them for taking his wife. It is almost certain that Hagar was one of those people he was given to become a handmaid of Sarah. And then Sarah hands her handmaid over to Abraham, and we have Ishmael that is born. This woman, overlooked, kind of just a piece of property, cast aside. But God saw her. Not only did he find and did he see her, he found her in the wilderness. He called her by name. He asked, "Where are you going?" And he heard her distress and her misery. God surely knew what had happened, and God surely knew what would come of the lineage that started with Hagar. But he saw her. He had compassion for her. He helped her. He loved her. And he sent her back to Sarah so that her child would live. A woman on the run in the wilderness, pregnant, no husband, scandal, probably wouldn't have made it. But the lineage there was preserved through her and through God seeing her. You see, God's way of seeing is not a passive observation. It moves towards people. Jesus shows us what that looks like in a passage that we all are probably very familiar with. And it's found in Luke 10, verse 25. And it says there, on an occasion, an expert of the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as well." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." And he wanted to justify himself, so Jesus asked, "Who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "The man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. The priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side." So he saw the man. He saw the man enough to know that he didn't want anything to do with this guy. And he didn't just walk by. He crossed the road and walked by. "So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him," and I can almost imagine that the Samaritan maybe was walking on the other side and crossed the road as well. I mean, the story is kind of setting, it's not there, but if you kind of read between it, they were here and crossed the road, they were here and crossed the road, the Samaritan was probably here and crossed the road. You can kind of hear that story there. He saw him and took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. When he put the man on his own donkey, he brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for extra expenses you may have." Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Let me rephrase the question. Which of these three men do you think saw the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The scripture says all three saw him. But who saw him? Who saw him the way God saw Hagar? Who saw the man? The priest didn't. He saw him from a distance and created more distance. The Levite surely didn't. He followed the footsteps of the priest, maybe even walked in the same steps crossing the road. The Samaritan saw him. And if you remember back at the beginning of that passage that I just read, Jesus answered the man questioning about the law. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. And likewise, love your neighbor as yourself." Put a pin in that passage for a minute. We'll come back to that part of that in a little while. The Good Samaritan showed that he loved with his heart. Had compassion, it says. He reached out to him. And he loved with his strength. How would strength be measured? Well, finances. That time he probably had finances, so he loved him with his strength. He took his own coin, he took his own money, paid for him. Some of you probably know, because my mom probably tells stories a lot, that I've been on a couple mission trips to Athens over the last few years. At the feast this past year, I spoke about one of the trips that I've been on, and it was in 2025 where I went, and I kind of went as a very stuck-up Christian, if you will. Look at me, I'm traveling overseas to go help people. I encountered a woman there. It's a much longer story than I'll go into today, but she was homeless, a refugee homeless. I was trying to give her a juice box, and I had red and blue ones, and she wanted a red one, but by the time I got to her, I only had blue ones. And she was angry because she wanted a red one. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Don't you know I'm an American with lots of pride and lots of sophistication, and I've got juice boxes, and you should just take whatever I give you and be happy. And I didn't see what was going on. And I really kind of was baffled by this, that this woman who had no juice box would complain that she wanted a red one over a blue one. And in the end, she refused the juice box. I'm like, what? You know, how many of you, especially some of you younger people that might be listening or in here, have you ever, your parents ever heard you say you get what you get and you don't throw a fit? That's kind of how I felt. You know, my pride was kicking in and, man, I'm doing a good thing here. Well, that evening we went back to where we were staying in this big apartment, and there was about 20 to 25 of us. And every day we debrief on what we were doing with the refugees and the homeless. And I told the story, and I told it very smugly. And I'll never forget, there was a woman sitting next to me. Her name's Amanda. I told the story, and she turned and looked at me, and she said, Brent, she wanted a red juice box. I was like, no kidding, she wanted a red juice box. I know, I was, Brent, she wanted a red juice box. And it almost destroyed me for a minute. It was so devastating that I had not realized that this woman on the streets of Athens, Greece, was a human being with wants and desires. I saw a woman standing there who needed a juice box, but I didn't see a woman standing there. I saw a goal, a checklist, a pat me on the back because I did something good object. But she wanted a red juice box. And I couldn't see her, nor could I help her. If I had been able to see her, even though I had blue juice boxes, I might have been able to help her. But instead, the opportunity was missed. The song I sang a minute ago, because does anybody hear her? Does anyone hear that woman today even? God put me in a place to be able to impact that woman's life with a red juice box. Or just seeing her. And in a long lineage of people who encounter her in their lives as a refugee in a foreign land, another opportunity was missed to see her, to hear her story. We didn't speak the same language, but I still could have heard her story. I still could have seen her. The Good Samaritan maybe didn't have everything that the man on the side of the road needed. But he took what he had. He took his bandages, his oil, his wine, his donkey, his money, his time to see the man that he didn't know, that he had no probably relationship with at any way at all. But you get what you get and you don't throw a fit, right? It's kind of what we tend to think, kind of feel. I'll tell you, my life was changed that day. I didn't realize how much, but that story has stuck with me, and as well as a few other ones. And I'm going to tell you, as a little aside here for a minute. My wife, as most of you guys know, she grew up as the daughter of missionaries. She lived in Belize for a while and in Nigeria for a while. I'm going to tell a story about her mom a little bit later, but her mom wanted to be a missionary from the time she could remember. She always wanted to be, and she grew up and became a missionary, serving Navajos in the southwestern part of the United States, and then going to Belize in Nigeria, and then ended up spending somewhere between 10 and 15 years in Kenya overseas as a missionary. And I always respected Bill and Jerry. That's my mother and father-in-law. But when Corey and I were dating, and I confess this to you because she brought this up to me a year or so ago, and I hadn't realized it, what had happened. We were dating, and we were getting close to being engaged, and she was feeling her life that she needed to go into the mission field. And she asked me one time, she goes, will you wait for me if I go for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? And I guess I told her no. I really don't remember that. I can make all kinds of excuses, and I said, I think I probably would have said something like, well, I can't guarantee it, but I've got to confess, if she remembered it that way, then that's what the story was that came to her. And So 28 years later, I'm standing in front of you realizing the regret I have for that comment. And now what just a small little experience about a red juice box has told me about the mission field and about helping the refugee and the homeless and the marginalized people. You see, in Matthew 9, when Jesus walked through a crowd and he was in all the towns and villages teaching in the synagogues, in verse 35, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them. You know, I know this is Matthew's telling of this, and it's we can play with words and semantics and everything, but he was in the towns and villages healing and proclaiming the good news. But it's not, Matthew points out that it's not until he saw the crowds that he had compassion on them. And I don't think that it was that Jesus was standing there and he saw this big multitude and he's just a sea of faces. And that was the compassion he had. Because one of the things I think God, Jesus can do that we cannot is he can see individuals in a crowd where we see a sea of faces. I just don't think human beings have the ability to see 1,000 people and see 1,000 unique faces. I think Jesus could look on that crowd and see how many of our faces were there uniquely. But it wasn't until he saw the crowd. And I know that he really saw them. It wasn't just like, yeah, there's a group of people. Because when you see a group of people, you just acknowledge there's a group of people. When you see a group of people, you can have compassion on them. And at that time, Jesus had compassion. He responded to them in saying, "The harvest is plentiful," is what he told his disciples, "but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field." Ask God your Father to send people with eyes to see. "Open my eyes that I may see," is what we sang a little bit ago. You know, growing up in this church, in this group, I remember singing that song all the way from back in Lake of the Ozarks days and the basement of, I thought I'd remember his name, and I can't remember the name, Rick Eckert's house with Jim and Bonnie Engel sitting in their basement singing songs like this out of that little bitty green CGI hymnal. I think it had 78 songs in it. I know the last one was "God Be With You Till We Meet Again." I remember singing this song. I remember thinking that that was God telling me to open my eyes so I could see His truth. And I think there's something to be said about that. I think there's more to it, though. It's open my eyes to see the people who are standing right in front of me. The glimpses of truth thou hast for me is the person standing in front of me. Oh man, that's kind of poetic. We could just change one of those verses and sing it that way, right? Compassion begins when the person is in front of us and stops being a category. Part of the reason I didn't see the woman who wanted the red juice box is because she was a refugee. That's easy. I know what a refugee is. I've got a whole definition in my mind and a whole box I can put her in. So she belonged in a category. She didn't belong in the human category, I guess, at the time, for me. So I also got an opportunity to go back to Athens this year. In June of 2026, I got to do another mission trip there. I was excited and concerned because have you ever done something in your life that was so big it kind of changed you and then you got an opportunity again and it kind of went ugh, and fell flat because you tried to manufacture the feeling again or you tried to redo it? It just wasn't the same. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not what happened. This trip was just as impactful. And I want to tell you about a man I met. So when we were handing out the juice boxes, we were actually handing out sandwiches in 2025, and that's through a ministry with a man named Artur. And he takes people, when you take sandwiches, that's a little snack and usually some kind of drink, juice box or something, and you walk around and he knows a lot of the homeless people, and you walk up and you hand them a sandwich, a snack, and a juice box. If they're awake, you talk to them. they're asleep, you just put it right next to them. They may want to talk. They may not. They may want to shake your hand. They may not. They may not look at you. Or they might. And it usually takes an hour and a half and 2 hours of walking through the city as it's getting dark. You see a lot of people. You see a lot of heartbreak. There was one family we ran across. It was about an hour before sunset. And there was this man, probably 30, 40 years old, refugee. He had a little 5-year-old daughter here and a little 6-year-old son here. And they were sleeping on the street. And he had them tight, like protective tight, holding on to them. And we walked by them, and there were 6 of us in the group that night, and we all cried. Here's a man sleeping in the last hours of daylight, protecting his children, letting them sleep. Why? Because you don't sleep at night on the streets, because it's dangerous. And so we're seeing people like this on our walk. About an hour in, we went into this park where we often do, and there's this man sitting on a bench, and he happened to be from England. So I started talking to him. Artur introduced me. His name is John. And Artur could tell that John and I were talking and enjoying our conversation. And in the park, they do about a little 30-minute loop. And he said, Brent, why don't you sit here with John? We'll do our loop and you come back. So I sat down with John and got to know him a little bit. Not great. We just superficial talk, nothing significant. Told me a little bit about himself, asked me some questions, I talked to him. But it was enough that when Artur came back, I felt like I didn't want to leave, but we had plans. We had to go to a really nice dinner, and so I had to do that. Thanks for some of you laughing. That was a joke. And so but there was a draw. So the next night we did another one of these, and at the beginning of the walk, I told Artur, I was like, you've got enough people here. Can I just go back to the park and go find John? He said, absolutely. So I went back to the same bench, and I found out that John goes there every night. That bench, everyone that's in the park that is there regularly knows that that's John's office. And so nobody else sits on that bench except for him and who he invites to. And I sat down and I spent an hour with John. And we talked, and I learned his whole story. I learned that the reason he left England is because of Margaret Thatcher, because he thought she was the devil personified, and that led me to know that he trusts no people in authority, so much so that he has some money set aside. He won't put it in a bank because he feels like people will steal it from him. So, I mean, we learned this kind of stuff. I learned that he had been married to a Greek woman for about 10 years, and they got divorced, and they have a child, and she is now grown, and I know that he's estranged from her. I know all kinds of stuff about very intimate things I learned about John in this hour. And I watched him, and we talked, and I got to see him. And more importantly, he let me see him. And in turn, he got to see me. And I let him see me. And there was a very deep, intimate connection between the two of us. About an hour went by, and Artur and the group came along, and it was about dark, and right around dark, John leaves his bench anyway, because he has this place, hidden place in the park where he lives, where he sleeps every night, and so he had to pack up his stuff to do that. And we started to leave, and I turned to him, and I went to shake his hand. He's dirty. His hands are dirty. He'd been smoking a cigarette while I was there with him, and he shook my hand back, and I said, hey, John, I don't know if I'm going to get back to see you this week while I'm here. I'm going to try to. I wasn't able to. We had other things we had to do with other ministries. But I said, until I get back to see you again, whether it's on this trip or some other trip in the future, I said, well, just take care of yourself. He said, Brent, taking care of myself is no problem. He said, it's the loneliness that's the problem. And I looked at him for a minute, and he was serious. And we said our goodbyes, and I walked away. And I thought, here's a man in Athens, Greece, surrounded by millions of people. He pointed to where he does his panhandling every day. It's right at the corner of this road that comes down from the Acropolis where the Parthenon is. And he sits there every day. He makes pretty good money. I mean, every night he has some food that he gets, and a little bottle of wine, so he has a glass of wine, and he always has a book to read that he buys. And I mean, so he has means. mean, he has a pack of cigarettes he can buy all the time. He has money saved in his little stash in the park. People walk by every day. He has some regulars that walk by every day and drop 5 euros or 20 euros in his little basket. Thousands of people come off that Acropolis every day. And he's lonely. Thousands of people walk by him every day. Probably most of them walk to the other side of the street to avoid him. And yet, I was given the opportunity to sit with him for about an hour and a half over 2 days and listen to a man with a story, a man with fears, a man with means, a man that enjoys his glass of wine every night, a man with a daughter who he dearly loves and can't see, a man with a country that he lives in now and a country that he is estranged from. And he's lonely, sitting there in the park by himself. His name is John. If you take nothing else from the sermon today, remember his name is John. I want you guys to remember there's a man in Athens named John that we all know about. In Mark 10, verse 46, then they came to Jericho, and Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city. A blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus. So, I want to take a little aside here, because I've read this passage many times in my life. And for some reason, today, or this week, preparing for this, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus. It's like, why in the world did Mark take the time to tell us that his name means son of Timaeus? Who's Timaeus? Do you guys know Timaeus? I don't know who Timaeus is. So it for some reason, it stuck out to me. So I looked it up. Timaeus means honored one. That's what his name means. Bart in Aramaic means son of. A blind, homeless beggar's name means son of the honored one. It's pretty cool, isn't it, that Mark took the time to point out who this man is. He's not just some beggar. He's actually a beggar that's probably been rejected by his family. He is the son of an honored one, which means he is the son of probably someone fairly important. And he's on the streets begging. Well, there's more to it in chapter 10, because right before this, we hear about two other people that we know are the son of someone. We know James and John, the sons of Zebedee, is right before this we hear that. So Mark is actually using this little literary device where he's called out James and John, who are honored ones walking around with Jesus, as the sons of Zebedee, to point them out. By the way, Zebedee, I have it somewhere. Zebedee means bestowed, the gifted one, or the endowed one. And so James and John are the sons of the gifted one. And then we find out that there's Bartimaeus, who is the son of the honored one. James and John, the son of the gifted one, loses sight of who Jesus is and asks to sit on his right hand. Bartimaeus, the son of the honored one, with no sight, knows exactly who Jesus is and asks Jesus to be healed. It's a pretty cool little thing that he's set up here. But there's even more in chapter 10, because if you read through chapter 10, and we won't do that today, you find out first that Jesus is talking about divorcing. And most of the time, divorce probably comes down to a lack of communication or a lack of seeing the other person of the value who they really are in your lives. Then he says, let the little children come to me, because the children are overlooked. And then there's a rich man that comes to him and says, what must I do? And Jesus says, sell everything. And the rich man couldn't see the value of Jesus over the value of his possessions. And then Jesus, the ultimate sight, looks and predicts his own death. He sees what is coming. followed by James and John's request. And then we get to this story of the blind man. And then in Mark 11, we move on from this whole thing, and it's now he's going to Jerusalem. So we're setting up the climax of Mark's story here. And every story in this has something to do with seeing. This whole chapter is about vision and seeing. So then continuing on in this passage, in verse 46, he was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of God, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and called and said, "Call him over to me." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet. He's calling you." You know, it's real easy to sit here and read scripture and criticize the disciples and things, but I mean, shut up. He's important. Don't talk to him. Oh, he wants you. Come on, get up, cheer up. Got to go to him. I mean, I know we'd do the same thing. It's just kind of funny to read it and to really kind of play this scene out in your mind, what they're doing. And I know I would have been one of the 12 saying the same exact thing. And in verse 50, throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked. Jesus had already seen this man. He knew what this man needed. He knew everything this man needed. But part of seeing somebody is not assuming what they need. Part of seeing someone is not assuming that a blue juice box will do when they really want a red one. Part of seeing someone is talking to them and hearing what they need. And that's what Jesus did. He stopped and he asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. To end the whole chapter on vision, he healed a blind man and told him to go. Where else can you go except for the kingdom personified in front of you in the life and body of Jesus Christ? So where did he go? He followed Jesus. The blind can see because Jesus sees you. And because we let him see us in that situation. There's another man, kind of with a little bit of a handicap maybe. A lot of us know him for the famous tree that he climbed up. A little sycamore tree. His name was Zacchaeus. You know, we tell this as a little children's story. But here's a man who was a tax collector. We all know what that usually means. Probably means he was a cheat. We even find out that he is, and he pays back many times over. But this little man not only wanted to see Jesus, he needed to be seen, and he didn't even realize it. And Jesus, with all of his wisdom, you know, if you're walking underneath some trees, oftentimes you may look up, but rarely you do. You're kind of looking at the road, especially roads that may stumble on. You're walking, talking with people. You could very easily walk underneath somebody in a tree branch and not notice. But he looked up and he saw Zacchaeus. And he invited him down. He said, "You know what? We're going to go spend the evening together. And I'm going to get to know you." And he did. And Zacchaeus' life was changed forever. We see the same thing with the woman who has the issue with bleeding. She didn't even want him to see her. She just wanted to touch his garment and go away. Did he let her? Not till he saw her. Not till he took the time and called her over and looked in her eyes. And he gave her the most valued name he could give anybody. He didn't call her woman. He didn't call her dirty one. He didn't call her anything except for daughter. He took the time to see her. He built a relationship and called her daughter. See, Jesus doesn't overlook people. You might say, well, Jesus is perfect, of course. Yep, he is. We are to be called to be like Jesus. We should not overlook people. I'm not saying it's easy, guys. I'm not trying to make light of this and say that this is something that is simple. So I want to return back to what we read earlier, and I told you to put a pin in it. It's Jesus' reply when he says, the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, it says actually in Luke. And that's the first and greatest commandment. The second one is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. We are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, strength, mind, everything. We are to love our neighbors in a like way. We're not to worship our neighbors, but we're to love them with all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our mind, and all of our strength. Can you imagine how much nicer your ride home tonight on the highway would be if you loved the people in the cars next to you with all your heart, and they loved you back with all of their soul? Maybe that's what the kingdom is, right? Oops, I guess it's noon. I should probably stop. My alarm's going off. I have one more story, and then I think I got one little more small scripture, and then we're going to finish up. I mentioned earlier my mother-in-law, Jerry Savuto. And, man, I wish you guys could have known her. She died about 10 years ago, actually. Oof. Yeah. 10 years ago in about it's the 30th, I think, of September was her is the anniversary of her passing. What a fantastic woman she was. She's a missionary, a nurse. She went to TCU to get her nursing degree. Corey and I, when we got married, don't ever do this, but on our first anniversary, we took a trip to Kenya. You know how hard it is to do better than your first anniversary when your first anniversary trip is to Kenya? Don't ever do something like that. But we went there to see them, spent a couple weeks there. Then we were able to go back. I think it was for our 5th anniversary. I don't remember which. It was right around that time of year. And while we were there, Corey and I were established, and we didn't quite have kids yet. And so we were dinks, double income, no kids. That's what dinks stand for. So we had some money, and Jerry had started a program at the hospital she worked at. It was called the Maua Methodist Hospital, where she was asking people to donate some of their tithes to this program. And you just gave some money, and then when she found a need for it to help somebody, she could go pull on that money. Because Maua had a policy where they would help anybody, but if you didn't have a way to either pay or to make arrangements to pay for your service, they didn't discharge you until you could arrange something. Which meant there were some people there that were complete, had nothing. They had no way of paying. That kind of caused a problem. So that's what this fund was for. There was a woman that came in, brought in by her dad. She was a woman. I think she was in her 20s, if I remember the story correctly. Her dad was older and probably in his 60s, so younger. Sorry. Thanks. and she brought the lady into the hospital. They had nothing. Now, Jerry at the time was not working as a nurse. She was working in quality control and different things, and so she wasn't in the room with people, but she heard about stuff. And so someone came to her and said, hey, we've got a situation. Can you help this out? In her office, didn't see the woman, didn't see the man. She went to the finance department, took some money out, paid their bill, and went back to her office. Never saw him, never said, hey, I did this for you. Just served somebody. She was walking back to her office as she turned a corner, and there was a man standing in front of her. And it was the dad. And he looked her in the eyes, and he said, thank you. There's no way he could have known. Nobody told him. It was secretive. It was meant to be anonymous. Somehow he knew. And as Jerry told the story, she didn't see him. She saw the face of Jesus standing in front of her. And that story has stuck with me because when we take the time to see people, people reflect back to us what it is Jesus has called us to do. When she took the time to start a program to help people that she hadn't even met yet that were in need, she went and paid that bill. Something about her glowed to that man that he knew that she had done this. And what she saw was the work of Jesus Christ working through her, reflecting back at her. And she said she saw the face of Jesus. It's a powerful story. It's not unique. If you think that's really cool and you love that opportunity, guess what? You've got it. All you got to do is open your eyes and see people. Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another. Shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. And I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will say, answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you as a stranger, invite you in, needing clothes? When did we see you in prison?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did to one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are accursed, into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me." They also will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick in prison and did not help you?" He will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these, did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Then they will go away to punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. Lord, when do we see you? When did we see Jesus? When did we help Jesus? Well, we helped them when we stopped to see somebody. We helped them when we crossed the road to help, not to avoid. We helped them when we let our hands get dirty by touching someone that was filthy. We saw him, we fed him, we clothed him when we did those things. When did we not? Well, when we yelled at the person that cut us off. When we got mad at someone at the grocery store who was in crisis, but they were in our way. When we drove down the streets of a big city and went, "Oh, these disgusting homeless people. Why can't somebody find a place for them to go?" Will you see him? You don't have to go to Athens. You don't have to go to Kenya. You don't have to go overseas. You just have to open your eyes. There are people everywhere. Next time you see somebody that you don't know in a situation you're uncomfortable with, hear them ask you the question, "Do you see me?" What's your answer going to be?